One of us just went through puberty.
It's all the copyrighted materials that they're keeping us from playing the real stuff. So I have to give better.
Oh, that's why you're
give
saying
better performances. Okay. Welcome to another episode of Mike and Oscar. We're kicking off our road to Avengers Infinity War today, and we will be doing these episodes. These are Marvel recap episodes, I guess you can call them.
Yeah, we're gonna review the entire MCU.
Yeah.
In 6 podcast episodes.
That's what we're going to try.
For all of
though.
You.
Yeah.
Oh, we will do it.
Take those 18 Marvel movies, compact them into 6 different episodes, 3 movies per episode, and kind of point you to show you where the Marvel Universe is and how it's been formed and shaped and what's leading into this huge movie
Come
event
on,
coming
dude,
out.
This is a piece of cake. I mean, we're used to 5 movie reviews with the Oscar categories, and we're going to, we're just doing 3
but the
here.
The stakes in this one are the so high. The world is at stake.
Disney and those stakes, they know what they're doing.
Yeah, no kidding, huh?
Disney Marvel.
So, this is the first episode of those, obviously. We will be doing the movies in chronological order, as we usually do, and we're going to be taking a look at a couple different things. Each episode, we're going to go through the 3 movies, the plot, the overview, how it shaped the MCU, where it goes from here. We're going to relate it to the Oscarism. Some of these were actually nominated for Academy Awards in their different years. We're going to go through that. We're going to take every movie and try to pick an Oscar category that it could have had a chance against. Some of those will be much more difficult to do than others, as you'll hear in this episode.
Coulda, shoulda, woulda.
And we're going to basically just talk about how the MCU has been formed leading up to Infinity War. Now, we are an Oscars podcast. We like to keep the Oscars lens on everything. That's why you'll get
it's
the awards.
Off-season, baby.
That's right.
So. You do whatever we want. Yeah, we're going to mix it up like we've been saying. We did a basketball-themed pod. We're very proud of that.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, it's not a huge hit so far, but we're proud to have that in our portfolio. We think
ton
if you
of
have
fun.
Any interest in basketball, movies whatsoever, even if you don't like the sport, go back and listen to that.
Or if you're angry enough at Sister Gene for Loyola making it to the Final Four and you ripped up a bracket or two in your time. But yeah, we had a lot of fun with that episode. We've did a lot of stuff obviously with the Oscars that were in early March that we finished up and had a couple look backs on, a couple Hollywood hot take episodes.
Oh, it's a vast catalog.
Yeah, we've
of
been
Mike,
busy.
Mike and Oscar
been pretty
so
busy.
Far.
We're flying by 50 episodes. We're at 56 now or something.
Absolutely. Putting in some work.
Hours of content because we love you.
Some other people that put in some work on their podcast network at The Ringers, Mallory Rubin and Jason Concepcion. I think this is going to be kind of a binge mode feel.
Sure.
So if you're fans of binge mode and those episodes, I know they did something a little bit like this. They take bigger chunks, but we're gonna
cards on the table. Mallory Rubin and Jason Concepcion, better looking people than us.
Absolutely.
But we're going to do our
100%.
Part.
And we're also not really going to do the deep dives in terms of the production and the specs. We're going to just we're going to give you some of those, kind of like an outline, but we want to dive into the reviews.
Yeah, so like we said, this is more content-based, plot-based, fun-based, and just kind of showing you, if you're a big fan of Marvel, if maybe you haven't been privy to the movies yet, you haven't seen them, you've been waiting for Infinity War like one of us two has to see most of these.
Did you just like figure that most of the people out there are just exactly like you and waited?
Yeah.
Because nobody did that. Nobody.
We'll get into that.
You eccentric weirdo
we'll
who
get
did
into that. But nonetheless, if you find any joy in these Marvel movies, hopefully this will help you out and maybe refresh some of you if you forgot some things or help you keep you up to speed.
Yeah, I'm going to wait until Game of Thrones. Maybe it'll get to a final season. If it doesn't, I'm not going to start watching it now. No, the whole country's watching it just like these movies.
It took me like 3 or 4 times to pick up The Walking Dead. And I thought I was into it, and then I stopped again after Negan. It was a mess, but nonetheless.
I can see that one.
We're going to do the 3 main Marvel movies that started the MCU. I almost said Spider-Man. Iron Man, The Incredible Hulk, Iron Man 2. Just to let everyone know, these are spoiler-filled reviews. We're not holding anything back.
Spoilers.
These
spoilers.
These have made $1 zillion, so presumably everyone has seen a majority of them multiple times, and we're not going to worry about spoiling any of them for you. And I'm probably the last person on Earth, like you just said, who hasn't seen all of these. So, if anything, we're spoiling them for me.
Yeah, I'm going to try not to get too far ahead. I may foreshadow some things for future MCU movies, but I'll try not to give. Yeah, I won't give too big spoilers.
So let's start with Iron Man 1, the first one that debuted in 2008. Now, to set this up, Mike is going to start with specs. I'll go into a plot overview, and then we'll have a conversation from there. And like we said, this is going to be an interesting take because you have Mike, who has consumed every movie a zillion times over, including all these Marvel ones.
Every single one.
And you have me, who I, like Mike said, and just made fun of me for, but rightfully so, I purposely waited on seeing these Marvel movies.
It's just the willpower that you have is astounding. It's contemptible.
I was too busy watching Legion.
And it's also...
Hide and Seek and...
Oh. That's why. Saw no, but six. I don't know whether to be mad at you or in awe of you. I don't know which was which. I think a last part of the prologue here is we want to say that we're not... people who have read all these comics either.
No,
so we're not going to come at this from the comic book angle. We're going to be all about the
movie critics, Oscar critics, and just guys that like movies.
Absolutely. So Iron Man specs, its box office won $318.4 million domestically. So that was a coup.
Not bad.
$266.7 million in other territories, the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Now, those numbers are going to go way up throughout our series here. $585.1 million worldwide box office.
Nice little half $1 billion for you.
Off of a $140 million budget. So the rule of thumb when you go to film schools, you got to make 2.5 times.
Made four times there, yeah.
Yeah, so that's in the... In the red? In the black?
It's black. Very black.
Black is good.
Very black.
I have no money. Marvel Entertainment Group became Marvel Films, which became Marvel Studios leading up to that.
All hail our Lord and Savior, Kevin Feige.
But this is basically before everything split into Disney, 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 Marvel, Fox, 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 Marvel, and Sony, 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 Marvel. This is a little before the big schism.
It's important to keep in mind that now everything is Disney, and so Disney-fied, and they obviously have that bank vault of cash that they can pull in and everything. But this was Marvel standing on its own and funding its own projects for a while.
Absolutely. So critical reception, Rotten Tomatoes, 94% positive. 7.7 out of 10 in terms of a critical score. 91% audience score. And 4.2 out of 5 audience rating.
So that's amazing, because you think about this, superhero movies had just succeeded, right? They were an embraced property. People love them.
X-Men, Spider-Man, Dark Knight.
And then Spider-Man 3 happens a year before Iron Man comes out, and it pretty much destroys a healthy amount of goodwill towards superhero movies that this box office had in terms of potential.
Blade 3 was around there.
Yeah, Blade 3.
Spider-Man kind of, 3.
Yeah,
they kind of went to the end of the line.
So the fact that there was this much money still waiting for a superhero movie kind of surprises me. But
Ang Lee's Hulk.
Oh, God.
So Metacritic put a 79 out of 100 score on that. IMDb's audiences also had a 7.9 out of 10, which is not correlated. Oscar nominations. It was nominated for Best Achievement in Sound Editing, lost to The Dark Knight, and it was nominated for Best Visual Effects, lost to The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Ooh.
Iron Man won 3 Saturn Awards, Best Science Fiction Film, Best Actor, Robert Downey Jr., and Best Director, Jon Favreau.
They also landed on AFI's Top 20 Movies of the Year list for 2008.
Nice. It's my lone production nugget is that actors were encouraged by Favreau to improvise much of their own dialogue as possible. So I didn't see that written in any of the other production logs. Just this movie, there was a lot of improvisation.
And you would think with the stakes that this movie had from both the story standpoint and the studio standpoint, that would be, they'd want to hone every piece of dialogue and make sure you're stuck on script and on the paper. But I guess when you're working with established veterans like RDJ and Gwyneth Paltrow and Terrence Howard, you can let them roll.
If you have masters of their craft.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, it feels like a lot of Downey Jr. improv a little bit. I think Favreau can just mix it up, too. I mean, he's from Swingers. None of that. Come on. Did you watch Swingers and you think that's all on the page? No way. Okay. So you're going with the plot?
Yeah, I'll start with the plot. Also interesting to me that they entrusted it to Favreau with, again, with the stakes of this movie. Jon Favreau, the movie, the feature-length films he was coming off was 2001's Made, 2003's Elf, which was a hit.
Oh, Elf Christmas was a movie, big hit, yeah.
And 2005's Zathura, A Space Adventure. So those
Jumanji
were his,
in Space?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly was his prologue leading up to
Jumanji
his...
in Space was not a profitable movie. $65 million budget. It only made $64 million worldwide. And in the theaters, maybe it was a crazy home video money winner, but
6.2 on IMDb. It wasn't, the worst movie ever conceived, but Jumanji in Space, yeah. Why not? Jon Favreau. But that was his lead up to Iron Man. And so him being entrusted with this giant property, this giant undertaking.
It was still elf coattails.
Yeah, I guess so. So let's go into the plot. Quick plot synopsis. Everyone knows what Iron Man's about. But Tony Stark is a full-fledged playboy living off the opulence achieved through his own hard work and the work of his father's company that he has succeeded in the ownership of Stark Industries. While Tony presents a very devil-may-care veneer, it's well-deserved as he has all the money, tech, and yes, women that he could possibly ever know what to do with. While making a weapons presentation to the military in Afghanistan, Stark's convoy is interrupted by a group of militia soldiers attempting to make Stark's weapons their own. What follows is Tony's escape from captivity, and through the help of fellow hostage Yinsen, he constructs both a miniature version of an arc reactor, which is now needed to keep him alive.
Yinsen's a big character, too. He's that doctor. Mm-hmm. He's the representation of the other half of the Muslim world, so he just didn't demonize these terrorists that he goes up against.
Also have a problem with him, which I'll get into in a second, because he was just cast aside. But and
he was collateral damage.
A functional weaponized suit of armor also made with the help of Yinsen to escape. Escaping in this way allows Tony to shift Stark Industries' focus from weapons manufacturing to energy production, a decision taken not too kindly by Tony's partner, his father's former right-hand man, and soon to be his own biggest threat, Obadiah Stane.
They make it a big point to like show like the magazine covers, the TV montage, all of Tony's stardom and his rise, where they show young Robert Downey Jr. pictures and they Photoshop them.
He's like the Trump, but liked.
Obadiah Stane, Jeff Bridges is always behind Tony Stark and like all those
pickup
pictures.
As the movie goes on, Tony learns two important things: one, how to construct and handle the iron suit we all know and love now, and two, that Obadiah Stane attempted to have him killed by the Afghan soldiers in exchange for Stark weapons and money as a power play. It's a superhero movie, so everyone knows what happens from here. Stane gains access to his own suit of iron that he demanded the Stark industry scientists construct earlier in the film, and we get a giant blow-off of iron suit versus iron suit, one helmed by Stane and one helmed by the man who ultimately defeats him, Tony Stark, with some help from his trusty assistant slash confidant slash sexual tension pseudo-love interest, Pepper Potts, played by Gwyneth Paltrow.
They set up Pepper Potts fairly well. I think Gwyneth Paltrow does a nice job. There's a little bit of strained forcedness in the sense that she is kind of without agency early on.
It takes everything in me to be able to stomach the Gwyneth Paltrow scenes because I am not a fan of hers.
That does not last, though, in this universe. It doesn't last on the third movie
Not very long at all.
She gets plenty of agency as it goes along. They introduce Jarvis. His AI intelligence is basically the butler that is within the house.
He's the smart
computer.
Home.
Yeah, the smart home
that becomes the operating system for the iron suit.
He's a major character.
Basically the co-pilot of all Tony's going around, flying around.
MCU will have more to say about him. And then the robotic arm was kind of funny. Mm-hmm. Like this robotic arm in Tony's lab, or it's almost like it's a workshop. It's like the most extravagant man cave workshop ever.
He's a playboy.
He's got all these beautiful cars and he's got all this crazy gear, and you have this one robotic arm that apparently has artificial intelligence that he can't get to help him do anything. Like this thing can't get anything right, and it's always like depressed and looking down,
and he instantly hears what he's saying. Like there's no standard language that he has to use. It's just anything he says.
So it's great when after Obadiah Stane uncovers what happens and he ambushes Stark at his house, that Stark has to rely on this stupid robot arm to save his life and get his backup core for his heart there. Metaphor for the human heart is a little on the nose.
You think so, huh? That glass case that Pepper Potts gave him that said proof Tony Stark has a heart wasn't too much for you?
But in terms of origin stories, this is a pretty strong one.
Yeah, let's talk about where this fits into the MCU. This is the kickoff. They needed this to hit, and I think without question it did.
Definitely minted a franchise star here.
Yeah.
You knew you're getting three Iron Man movies, two or three, because he was a monster hit after this. I don't know if they knew even at that time that they'd have a whole cinematic universe of 27, 30 and counting films.
I think they came right out with Phase 3. I think they went up to Phase 3, which was the initial 18, I want to say, 15 or 18.
Right. But it's going to spawn 50 movies.
Forever,
especially
now.
Movies.
Especially now.
Can we extend it?
Yeah. But Robert Downey Jr. was kind of a risk to go into this with. He was the guy. what amazed me, and I remember thinking this back in 2008, he had his problems throughout his youth. He, you know, he had the Oscar role with Chaplin he was up there for, and he had a lot of hits and misses, problems with, you know, his name was in the papers and whatnot, as a lot of young stars are. But as soon as he was announced as the face of this phase one, as Marvel was doing this big cinematic universe, before cinematic universe was in all of our lexicons.
Right.
He was a superstar. He showed up everywhere in suit and tie with these dark shades. He was living the part, shaking people's hands. He was very personable in interviews. And it's almost like him being picked made this backdoor agreement with, like, listen, we really need you to be the face that we can rely on for this property. And he became basically a mini Tony Stark in his real life with the interviews and everything I saw from him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think his success allowed this cinematic universe to happen. I mean, definite pioneer that they knew that they at least had this trilogy to bank on, right? And if something else didn't work, as we'll see soon enough, they could rely on Iron Man films making money. I don't think they expected to make this amount of money.
No, and I think that's a good point because, again, superhero movies, you almost thought they were kind of has-been at this point. X2 wasn't that great. Last Stand, I think, was the third X-Men movie. Not received as well. Spider-Man 3 we talked about. So to see that there was this wealth
But they did make money, though, even though critical.
Right, sure.
They made a ton of money. So it's two different conversations in a way. Something I wanted to point out, they definitely were planning the Avengers from step one here.
Oh, yeah. You see it. The first post-credit scene is Iron Man returning to his home with Tony Stark after day out, glad-handing and kissing babies, and he's met there by an eye-patched Samuel L. Jackson who introduces himself as Nick Fury and says he wants to talk to Tony about the Avengers initiative, and that's our first taste of what we're leading off to. And everybody knew that was coming. Everybody had known about the Marvel phases and the MCU being coined a term, and so I think that was like the first taste, especially it being a post-credit scene, being an extra nugget, which not a lot of movies were doing or properties were doing up to that point, to give you that little taste, that little morsel at the end. I think it sent everything into overdrive.
Just the word Avengers probably made people go nuts. All the comic fans go nuts. I do think that the plot structure was interesting for this movie because they took a bit of a different tactic for their villains. Like they're a little more clever with how they structure their villains in the MCU than in other superhero franchises. In other superhero franchises, it's typically you have your hero who's has his origin story. Mm-hmm. Even if it's a sequel, he kind of has to go through some kind of trauma or whatever, you know,
which
change,
we'll see,
right?
Yeah.
Even in the Batman movies, something's changed that he has to get his groove back or whatever. That's the wrong word used.
No, Stella was the star of this, I think.
In Marvel, in the MCU, they often hide the ball. They often don't tell you who the big bad is until middle of the film. It's not like Batman movies or X-Men movies where the villain is on the scene creating all the chaos. Muscle flex scene number one. Muscle flex scene number two. Look at The Dark Knight and Joker. Even Christopher Nolan went with that quote-unquote superhero film paradigm. This is not that way. You don't get Obadiah Stane showing himself to be the true villain. Those muscle flex scenes happen off-screen until the middle of the movie
when he finally gets one. Yeah. You know? And even the reveal in this case of Obadiah Stane, it kind of comes in passing on the red carpet almost as a throwaway comment when him and Tony are posing for pictures. You know?
Right.
Like you kind of, that's his first taste of manipulating Tony or not trusting Tony, sticking a knife in his back.
He may have totally guessed or maybe have known from the comics that he was a bad guy, but he doesn't. Yeah, and then his whisper is like, all right, maybe he's underhanded deals, but you thought going into that
it was going to be the Afghan militia.
It was going to be fall into a, you know, thing of toxic waste.
That
to
said,
a bad guy.
What did you think about Jeff Bridges as Stane as the big baddie at the end?
I think the casting is interesting because
interesting's a good word.
Interesting's the worst word, as Viggo Mortensen would say in that movie last year. What the hell was that movie? But they use apparent Captain Fantastic.
Yes,
Captain Fantastic. It's like interesting's not even a real word. It doesn't even matter. He wouldn't let his kids say it. Hippie parenting. Anyway,
cancel Viggo Mortensen.
No, I liked it. I liked it.
Oh,
that's why I'm quoting
him. Book him.
book him. I thought he did a nice job. I think they didn't want to put him behind a bigger suit. Like, they relied on his face being the face of evil at the end of this movie, which was very interesting. You had him in street clothes, ambush Stark. And
how have you not said anything about the bald cap they made him wear yet? You who are like the man when it comes to wigs and hairstyles.
Because Disney knows how to do that, my friend.
Oh, no. You didn't see this little jagged edge all throughout his forehead?
No, I didn't see it.
Oh, it was painfully obvious in some scenes. But that's, I mean, well, not as fanatical about
it. You have bald cap problems. I have wig. I have artificial wig problems.
I'm the skin guy and you're the hair guy. That's good. That's not creepy at all.
The skin and the hair guy and Oscar. Here we go. Come back next week.
It's just us licking our lips into the microphone. I didn't understand why.
We're going on YouTube soon. You can't wait.
I didn't understand why Stane. Why did his voice change at the end when he was in the iron suit? Like, he's talking normally the whole time. And then when he's in the iron suit, he talks. Like, you're not becoming the monster.
I didn't notice that either.
Oh, my, it was bad. That was. I mean, I know I'm quibbling, and maybe this is. It was my first time actually seeing Iron Man, so.
It's interesting that they made him keep the suit open basically the whole time, except when he was in the air. Though. Yeah. That was cool. I mean, that's just a testament to Bridges, to finally answer your question.
I enjoyed Bridges as a big baddie. I thought it was a nice. You know, the first movie, I don't think you want to show everything that you can do. So he was a capable bad guy. He was clever. It was an old-time friend, so you had that emotional attachment to him that they kind of built on a little bit, not
right.
greatly, but and he was easily defeated, really. Well, Pepper Potts was the one that kind of brought him down.
I mean, look at the characterization of DC versus Marvel over all these years, right? Marvel has always been characterized as having, oh, we got strong strong characters for the heroes.
Right.
Our heroes are going to be the most
DC's
fun.
DC's the villains,
And DC, the Joker, got the villains, right? They got the weight, their story weights behind the villains. Now, I think Marvel's trying to deal with this problem, interestingly, by hiding the ball with the villains, by trying to be clever with them, by having star power like Jeff Bridges at the time.
And by hiring Josh Brolin to be every villain in a Marvel property.
Well, also kind of have the rival be the villain. And DC ran up against that problem recently. And that was, but that's another little twist on it. So you have rival as villain, and that's another way to get past your villain problem.
Rhodey, Terrence Howard was also in this movie. He was supposed to play what would go on to be War Machine. He's obviously replaced in Spider-Man.
I'll have reasoning
Iron
on
Man
that.
Too.
Yeah, I'll have your reason later.
I like Terrence Howard, too. I thought he played his role well. I'm actually a fan of Terrence Howard's for the most part. I know a lot of people aren't out there. I liked him. Just want to say the one quibble I have with the Yinsen character before we do best scene.
Sure.
Yinsen is like the surrogate for a section of the audience. He's the, you don't want to say apologist, but he's supposed to be the friend and whatnot. But the dialogue when Tony finally escapes from the cage and Yinsen is the casualty and he's got the hole in his heart. He's about to die. And he's like, come on, Yinsen. We're going to go see your family. Come on, get up. And Yinsen's like, my family's dead. I'm going to see them already.
Yeah.
Like, okay. you could have mentioned that at some point. You're in captivity with the guy.
Well, yes, but it's also he's a freaking hero because he didn't mention that. He's helping all along to do the right thing.
All that was an apology so nobody could be possibly mad at Tony Stark for having Yinsen be lost.
Oh, this is a revenge fantasy against terrorists who just hit us 7 years ago.
Yeah,
this is
probably,
Marvel's way
to
do that. I mean, think about this. If we get into our usual thing where we say half measures or we kind of look between the lines or get behind the curtain, they exploited.
Yeah.
We're at war with Afghanistan and Iraq when this movie came out. This is a fantasy way for people to combat that.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue it. Yeah,
I mean, of course it's effed up. But this is their way to say that not all Muslims are bad. Simple as that. Oh, yeah, it's transparent in that regard. I agree with you. I did want to mention something about screenwriting seminars. When instructors teach fantasy, science fiction, and horror writing, the conventional wisdom usually tells writers to avoid authority organizations, right? So don't have the cops as a major force, like right up front when you're dealing with the supernatural or the supranatural. So you want them to come after the fact because you want people to be the underdog. Also, when you have these fantastical elements, you want the world at large and the authorities that be to be dismissive of them.
Sure.
This story is kind of unique, and the X-Men is the same way in many, many, many ways, I guess. But this story is fairly unique in that you have these supernatural elements, and the governments are thrown right at the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
You have senators, and you and it's into the plot. So friends and foes are these authoritative organizations, these authoritative government characters. It's not necessarily, and it happens once in a while, but usually it's like South Park where the cops storm in right after all the action's done. They come in right afterwards. But that's like every movie about the supernatural or the fantasy, and even superheroes, of course, they fit into that regard. This is not that.
Yeah, no.
This is kind of interesting. And the other movies weave it in even better.
Listen, you're the screenwriting guy, and then I will submit to you with
that take. I'm a nerd.
No, it is interesting, and it's something that's prevalent when you think about it, in that it is. You definitely have, especially in a time like you just said, it was supposed to be so patriotic, and these messages for rebuilding after 9/11, and you have basically the government is the stand-in bad guy, the big overshadowing force against all our heroes here, and our heroes are, for the most part, vigilantes, and that storyline is brought in here. You get the Batman, mm-hmm. you know, is he a hero or is he a vigilante, with the Iron Man character in this story. Tony Stark doesn't reveal himself as Iron Man until the very end.
And yes, I'm sure it has to be, it must be, it is in the comics as well. So, I mean, those innovations happened 50 years earlier, but for Marvel and the MCU, for them to have the cojones to put it in the movies and not dumb that part down or change that part, it was interesting. So Oscar lens, Mike?
Yes. So what we're going to do with the end of it is we're going to try to, like I said, talk about what one aspect of the film we would have argued at least has a place amongst the Oscars in that year. Mm-hmm. Mine, 2008, I don't see how this didn't get into the adapted screenplay conversation.
Wow, yeah, that's exactly what I had.
Oh, cool.
I thought this was not an Oscar movie, number one. I don't think, if it came out today, like, I would write it off. Like, if it came out in March, I would give it, like, a 86, 87. That would have been my grade.
But that said, I would have done the same with Benjamin Button.
Well, Benjamin Button at least looked phenomenal. Like, you can't say it didn't look phenomenal.
It was Forrest Gump. Redone.
Fine, but just the visuals were pretty staggering.
Okay.
At least you can make an argument for that. So obvious. Like, the visuals of this movie, I don't think they hold up all that well.
They hold up better than some other ones we'll get to in a minute.
Yeah, I don't know. For me on my TV, not so much. So I would even quibble with visual effects. I mean, it worked at the time, I guess. But it's obvious green screen when Tony's in the suit, opening up the suit. And it just bothered the hell out of me. Whenever I see, like, his face, it's like a human face and a cartoon body. And whenever you see that, it's a little annoying. But, yeah, I did say that the origin story was super strong. And I wrote that down here, that best adapted screenplay would have been my choice as well, if it was a weak year, kind of like this one.
Yeah, and of 2008's nominees, Slumdog Millionaire won Best Adapted Screenplay, Benjamin Button, Doubt, Frost Nixon, and The Reader. So it was a strong year for adapted screenplays. I could see that. You could make the argument that this and Benjamin Button are on the same playing field, I think.
God, The Reader. I watched that film. I listened to that audiobook. I hated every minute of both. Well, except for the gratuitous nudity. I mean, I'll agree
course,
with that.
Of course.
I'm a red-blooded human being.
Doubt, Frost, Nixon, Slumdog Millionaire, though. Three very strong contenders. What was your favorite scene? Best scene?
The origin story, escaping the terrorists. I like that. I like that whole... And then I think my next best scene, so when they actually played the song Iron Man, the heavy metal song that we all... You
got goosebumps.
Yeah. So those are my
penis
two favorite...
Became fully erect. I'm a man in America!
Two favorite things in this movie. Yeah, absolutely.
My favorite was... it wasn't a scene. It was what Favreau did, especially in his directing, and it's kind of the delayed gratification. You don't see the Iron Man suit in full until like two-thirds of the way through the movie.
Oh, so you were teased.
Right. I like the delay, because that's what the origin story should be about. It should be about your character becoming the character.
Sure.
And so he doesn't fully become the Iron Man until right before, basically, he has to have the showdown with Stane.
Yeah.
And he goes through the quibble with Terrence Howard's Rhodey character by the air lesson with there's stuff that happens, intricate stuff that happens that can't happen until he is Iron Man, but they hold off on him being the fully fleshed cherry red Iron Man suit until at the last possible minute. I like that. I thought that was a nice touch.
You're consistent. Going back to your movie watching habits, you know, you're very patient and very...
It's the exact opposite of the way I am as a human being. It's my money and I want it now!
So what was your worst scene now?
I don't understand the Jeff Bridges grizzly voice. Like, what? Do those suits even have speakers on them? How is he being so loud and heard?
Bad guy.
Are they on the same radio frequency?
They did get into a fight, you know, over traffic. So, I mean, he was really bad there, Mike.
I didn't like it. The on-the-nose dialogue in some sections I also had a problem with. It was too on-the-nose. That Yinsen scene. It's just like, he might as well have just stared at the camera and said, "Don't be mad at Tony that I'm dying."
Don't hate all Muslims. Look at what right. I just did.
Those were some of my...
Yeah, I could see some of that. This movie, for me, is not an elite Marvel property. I didn't love a lot of the quips. Some of the quips were a little... You're too quippy. I'm usually like a quip guy. I'm usually very tolerant, but some of them didn't land for me upon rewatch. Maybe it was funny, you know, 10 years ago. Tony Stark wasn't as funny as I remember him, and I don't know how PC he is anymore either.
Do you think that's what it was? Does this Tony Stark character even get made in this day and age?
I wonder about myself though. Like, am I not laughing as much now? Because I'm more like
jaded by the social
those antennas are on alert.
I had the same concerns, very similar concerns. Where I was like, "Wow, they got away with this just 10 years ago."
And then maybe I laugh even less because I know what a raving, ridiculous hypocrite I am,
and that the government's watching you, or the Russians at least.
Hydra, but that's later. Oh. Okay,
we'll move on to the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, box office. A measly $134.8 million.
Mm.
Okay, $134.8 million. Other territories, $128 million. The worldwide cum was $263.4 million off of a $150 million budget. That's not good there, Mike.
Wah, 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 wah.
That didn't make money. So this is a 67% Rotten Tomatoes score, 6.2 out of 10, with a 71% Rotten Tomatoes audience score and a 3.6 out of 5 Rotten Tomatoes audience rating.
And that may all be too high still.
Perhaps. Metacritic, 61 out of 100.
Maybe too high.
But look at this. This is the eye-popping stat out of this. And I didn't do cinema scores on everything unless I see something, right, that wows me. A-minus cinema score.
Wow, really?
Yeah. A-minus cinema score. Well, so people loved it when
it
came out.
Put the Metascore in context for you. It was the 182nd ranked release of 2008 was The Incredible Hulk with its 61 Metascore.
Right.
It scored similarly among other 2008 releases such as Red, Role Models, which is an absurd ranking. That movie is hysterical. Madagascar Escape to Africa, the number 2, the Madagascar sequel.
Those are all pretty good.
And 2 points lower than The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants 2.
The Incredible
Hulk was, but you said it an A-minus cinema score.
Right.
I don't know what's going on.
Well, I wonder when these rankings are compiled. Like, is it just a running ranking? So people watching The Incredible Hulk 10 years later.
I'm going to give it to you. That's a hell of a question.
To
That's
that
somebody that knows what they're talking about
because
could answer.
The cinema score basically happens right
at
then.
At the time of, right.
It's
sure.
The time of what
but still,
audiences think of the movie they just watched.
The IMDb and the Rotten Tomatoes score, they all kind of reflect the Metacritic score more so than the... IMDb is a running score, you're right. So yeah. I don't know, but...
What I would wonder is if did... Marvel just take a big swing and miss at this. Did they? All right, we're gonna put $150 million into this movie, and we delivered the goods for the audience that went to it because they liked it, but we just totally miscalculated what the audience would be.
I guess I would say there wasn't a lot of repeat viewings. I mean, the opening weekend got it $55.4 million of its 134 total. Gross domestically.
I'm gonna have a theory coming up, but
so that may the 55.4 is 41% of its total gross of its run. I don't think there was a lot of repeat viewings. 17th highest domestic gross of 2008, 21 overall for the year.
It's
not
a big
great
cookie cutter in its plot and whatnot. No big awards at the Oscars or anywhere. To be honest with you, it was some small film festivals, but some small outlets had nominated it for some awards.
The movie sucked!
No. A production nugget, Ed Norton went uncredited as a screenwriter on this one. He rewrote Zach Penn's screenplay when he was cast. It was a part of his deal. Norton was forced to write his draft in a single month's time before production, and he basically kept polishing it until halfway through principal photography. So my question to you, Michael, did this movie as a box office failure? Now, Ed Norton could totally excuse himself because he had to write it so fast, but did this movie as a box office failure for Ed Norton, who had his hands all over it, was it the beginning of his downturn?
Was it the beginning of his downturn as a film star or in the MCU?
As both. Definitely as because he's fallen off the planet.
Yeah, he's always been one of my favorite actors.
Right. But
this kind of started his legacy of he's just difficult on set. He's difficult to work with. He's too involved in the process. He wants too many fixes. And that's all stuff you kind of heard at the time, which I don't think is, I mean, I don't know, obviously, having never worked with the guy, but it all kind of came out at once, which I always thought was a little unfair. I kind of felt like piling on. That said, you're right. He just hasn't been around lately.
Well, look at his next 5 years. So he does The Incredible Hulk, and then Pride and Glory comes out where he's starring in a mid-budget movie. Mm-hmm. The Invention of Lying, Leaves of Grass, Stone, The Dictator, Moonrise Kingdom. He's a bit part. He's a bit part in Bourne Legacy. So,
and this is a guy coming off Rounders, coming off
Leading into The Hulk, he has The Italian Job, 25th Hour, Red Dragon. He's in Frida, The Score, Fight Club, yeah. Keeping the Faith, he's American History S, Rounders. He's carrying those movies. Yes, he's got some big cast members along with him. But
maybe it was the perfect storm. Maybe he did get upset with his part in this. Maybe Marvel got upset with his rewrites. And maybe audience members were hulked out. Ang Lee's Hulk movie came out 5 years prior.
But this movie is the nail in the movie star coffin for Ed Norton. Like, he does not star.
Oh, I hear you. As a protagonist. I'm saying maybe it's a collection of all these things as opposed to one thing. And maybe he just got, he could have stepped away too. I don't know. I mean,
they joke about it in Birdman, obviously, but he doesn't star in another big movie.
No, you're totally right. And it blows my mind. He was one of my favorite leading men. I hope we're near a renaissance for him. I love him as an actor. I
think he's in Isle of Dogs. So we're going to have Isle of Dogs for. He's a dog.
How dare you say that about Ed Norton?
No, he's a dog in Wes Anderson's.
No. He's just a dog.
And he's a dog.
Cancel Ed Norton. Going to the plot of The Hulk, not going to have a whole lot of surprises for this one. Bruce Banner is a scientist that had infected with gamma radiation, which leads him to lose control of himself once his heart rate and rage reach a certain level, turning him from man into a larger-than-life green monster with unstoppable capabilities known as Lou Ferrigno. While Banner is somewhat ashamed and overly protective of his alter ego, he's also in hiding, aware that the American government, there's that name again, wants nothing more than to entrap him for a study to hone the Beast's awesome capabilities for themselves and for wartime. To further complicate matters, Banner's one true love interest, fellow scientist Betty Ross, a woman who knows not of Bruce's whereabouts or even proof of life until he reunites with her halfway through the film, is the daughter of the Army general charged with capturing the Hulk and bringing him in for study, General Thunderbolt Ross.
Thunderbolt Ross.
Played by William Hurt. Numerous encounters between man and Hulk prove that no soldier, regardless of how committed to combat they are, is a match for the awesome power of Hulk, which is all it takes for one soldier, Emil Blonsky, played greatly by Tim Roth, to get fed up and demand that he get injected with Banner's blood and chemicals via Banner friend and curious scientist Samuel Stearns. The injection completely transforms Blonsky as well, and he becomes the Abomination, a creature hellbent on finishing off Hulk once and for all. This leads to the final battle between Hulk and Abomination, which takes place all through the Manhattan streets and buildings. Literally through the Manhattan streets and buildings.
Mm.
The army watches as our hero finally conquers his most recent baddie. However, knowing that if he stays, the battle with the army will only rage on, Hulk takes one last look at those around him, General and Betty Ross included, and gallops off the New York night, evading capture once more. So that's the Hulk. That's the
Incredible Hulk.
That's the Incredible Hulk, yes, the Incredible Hulk.
So Bruce Banner goes from Eric Bana to Ed Norton, and Jennifer Connelly becomes Liv Tyler, and Sam Elliott goes back and
that's what's amazing.
Coors and becomes William.
It's a really good Sam Elliott, by the way. No doubt there's some similarities between the 2003 movie and this one, which I was kind of surprised they would repeat some of the same beats, but
same cast. Yeah, same cast, same general framework. This one, for me, felt like more of that traditional superhero plot line, though. Like, you have your big bad becoming the big bad, so it's his origin story, but then you have the Hulk established, and it's just like, all right, muscle flex scene, Hulk. Muscle flex scene, Hulk. The bad guy gets stronger, wants to take him on, and it's just like touting up the big fight. You would be familiar with this as a big WWE fan.
Not familiar.
Well, so
yeah, no, you're right. But I mean, at the same time, I feel like there was so much screwed up in this movie.
So I guess I would wonder is, like, for that A-minus cinema score, did this quench the thirst of for a Hulk movie just based on, like, all the meathead, all us meathead fans, like, back then?
But that's my point. That's my point. It's would seem to be easy to write a Hulk movie, right? How hard is it to what do you need? You need a bad guy that's just as big as Hulk, a Hulk smash scene, a giant fight, maybe two.
That's what they tried to give you.
Yeah, but they missed so many beats.
But people thought they delivered the goods. And I remember
which blows my mind.
At the time, you know, the people I saw it with liked it.
Well, this is one of the few Marvel ones I had seen at the time. I think I saw this in 2009 or 2010. But it, like, even then I was like, okay, it's a movie. I wasn't, like, blown away by it or impressed by
it. Yeah. It doesn't fit all that well into the cinematic universe, though, I guess, to get us finally going on the discussion.
This is supposed to be another introduction, another character building one to introduce you to the character of the Hulk that's going to be around for the MCU.
It foreshadows that Eric Bana and Ed Norton are going to become Mark Ruffalo.
Yes, because
they
exactly
both kind of look on different ends of this Caucasian man spectrum.
They enter the mechanism that Jeff Goldblum had in The Fly, and they come out.
They come out as Ruffalo.
Right.
Okay, that would make sense. But, you know, Ang Lee gives us the origin story, and then this Hulk jumps. I mean, they were conflicted from the beginning. It's not a sequel, but it's not a reboot, but it's not a sequel. So what the hell is it?
It's a very similar problem to what the first Andrew Garfield Amazing Spider-Man movie had, because we had just done Spider-Man trilogy, and you're rebooting.
And I read something about this, and Ed Norton and Zach Penn, the writer, the initial writer, was like, well, I wanted to be like Aliens. Because Aliens was not really a sequel, not really a reboot either. But you had the same freaking cast, though, in Aliens. Yeah. I mean, the same star, at least.
Yes.
So it's enough of a... Yeah, I mean, it's a...
That's right. Zach Penn didn't see Aliens.
But
that's all that means.
It's Gone with the Wind meets Waiting for Godot, which I've never seen.
I don't know what that quote means. I mean,
Aliens is basically a continuation. It's just much bigger. It's Cameronized.
They change genres. That's all it is.
Yeah. I mean, action spectacular. Yeah, different. Well, that's not the genre. We can have a genre discussion later. Or never. Preferably never. So this is a Jekyll and Hyde story. The duality was thoroughly explored by Ang Lee. And we get some of that here. Like you said, people are kind of tired of the male aggression metaphors, that this is the monster inside of every man that doesn't play well to the other half of the population, as the box office proves. So if they made a $50 million movie about Hulk, it might have delivered all the goods for just the meathead guys like us out there. We could have been, you know, fairly well happy with it. Then again, could they get all these set pieces for $50 million? But this is why they haven't made another Hulk standalone movie, folks.
This movie also lacked in explanations as far as, like, why some characters just showed up in certain places aside from just dramatic effect. Like the fight in the college green at the very end, Ty Burrell, who's playing Liv Tyler's boyfriend at the time, just shows up out of nowhere just to hug her. And Liv Tyler is allowed... While the army is battling a giant green alien.
Yeah, let's get close to that.
Yeah, Liv Tyler's allowed to just hang out by one of the tanks. It's like, what? And the airplane shoots down with her right there.
I mean, she knows Bruce is there, so she's getting close. She's trying to, she knows she can calm down Bruce,
I guess.
You think
they might have set the perimeter. They might have set the perimeter for a gun battle.
Yeah. It's an unexpected gun battle. Why am I arguing for the whole... All right, keep moving on. But they do set up Banner on the run. You know, he's hiding out, and that's become something that he's going to continue to do. I don't know why having what he has, he would like go to the most populated area he can think of.
There was a lot of questionable decisions in this movie. The one thing, one of the highlights that I was pleased to see, I said during our Black Panther review, I can't remember a Marvel movie integrating itself so visually and obviously into American life. You know, that Black Panther took place in Oakland. They let you know it was Oakland, California, blah, blah, blah. And then this movie, they let you know Brooklyn, Manhattan, they're in New York. They don't, it's not Gotham City where it's New York adjacent. They okay. use the word. So you know this is taking place supposedly in real life. So these mutants are a part of our everyday world. This is the universe they're in. The MCU exists in America.
This was at kind of the height where blockbuster movies just destroyed major cities.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess that's they did a good job destroying New York. I agree. So, I guess we go into the Oscar lens now. Best scene, worst scene, you got anything else?
I have nothing else. I'm going to have a lot in worst scene, but I don't. What's your best scene? Or no, let's do Oscar first. I'm sorry, Oscar lens. So, let's do Oscar lens first. What do you have?
I have no Oscar lens.
Yeah, that'll make two of us.
No, this is not an Oscar movie. I mean, Ed Norton's performance would probably be the closest thing
oh,
I could...
Oh, God, I couldn't even... The idea behind the Oscar lens, the Oscarism, is that, like, we want to argue which one of the big seven could make a case for. One of the big eight awards, big seven awards.
Visually, it's a cartoon. I mean, it's not like...
That's one of the problems I have with it. If you take the final battle between Abomination and Hulk, you view it as a cartoon, it's impressive. It's a good movie.
Right.
If you view it as it's supposed to be real life, it's not. It doesn't pass.
It's less cartoony than Ang Lee's Hulk. But, I mean, Hulk's so hard to do because he's so green. That's why, like, I like Thor Ragnarok where they make it dark green. And he's up in such a crazy, batshit crazy sci-fi world. So against that backdrop, it makes more sense. Against, like, regular wilderness, the Hulk is so cartoony.
And the scene, I guess we're doing... best scenes, worst scenes, without even thinking about it. But the scene where Ed Norton's becoming the Hulk, he's on the table when Samuel Stearns is like trying to turn him into the Hulk and see his why have that shot? Why show Ed Norton full body transforming if it's going to look like that? It looks so hacky.
At the time, maybe it looked good, but now it just looks so CGI.
But again, we're not even talking 2003. Yeah. This is a decade ago.
It looks CGI. The practical effects are admirable somewhat because they really do incorporate things blowing up in real life on the college campus in that scene. Sure. So I'm going to say that's my favorite. And I remember when I watched it the first time, that was my favorite sequence. However, upon rewatch... my favorite stuff was all the callbacks to the original TV show.
I have that too, working in the theme. I thought it was really
the same music.
Now, I don't know if that's me liking the Hulk TV show or me liking Family Guy's obsession with the Hulk TV show's theme song.
Wait, you like Family Guy?
Yeah, if you couldn't tell. But I liked a lot of the nods for Igno playing the bodyguard.
I thought you just matched your vocal patterns to that show.
Fantastic beefs. The Lou Ferrigno playing the security guard, he had a lot of nods to the show.
I even like the forbidden romance that they built up that scene where they're about to get hot and heavy and they couldn't do it.
Maybe you need to go on a date. I don't know. No, I get it. Look, there's not a lot to love, I don't think, about this movie.
The finale's okay if you're like just totally brainlessly watching it, I guess.
The biggest
Why does he talk?
Why is Blonsky, like, all the Emil Blonsky scenes, Tim Roth I love as an actor, but I don't, one of the first things we do is we see him shoot a dog that's barking off screen. He's like, because this is the bad guy. It's like, okay, that's fine. He didn't need to do that. And then all the scenes where the general is talking to Blonsky, every scene ends with Blonsky giving like a cryptic one-liner and then just staring into the camera menacingly.
His characterization is like four lines over four scenes. And
I'm a fighter.
And then he has one.
I'll do it for as long as I can. If I can take what I know now and put it into the body I had 10 years ago, that'd be a guy I wouldn't want to fight.
I know. He's broken down into pure characterization.
So
that's
bad.
It. Yeah, no, it doesn't really work.
So that was my biggest problem with the film.
He's not a complicated villain I have in capital letters.
No.
So, yeah, I would agree.
The Joker, slightly more depth.
Slightly, just by an edge. I guess the only Oscar-worthy element that I could stretch for, Michael, is sound editing. Because they're creating sound effects.
Wow, good for you. I mean, this is not something I would have come up with, so yeah, good for you.
I can't.
No, why not? I guess. It's not something I would have thought of, but
We didn't love it. So,
yeah. So Hulk wins the battle of the Abomination. And we get a pre-credit, post-credit scene in this one.
Oh yeah, that happens before the credits. All right, that's my favorite thing about the movie now, because I like those things.
Tony Stark comes in.
I have to pee, then I hate those things.
Right. Come on. Tony Stark comes in to Thunderbolt Ross, who's beaten down. Hulk got away from him. He's just drowning his sorrows in that green drink that Bruce Banner starts off the movie working on that factory. But regardless, Tony Stark comes in and he's like basically explains the Avengers initiative. Mm-hmm. He's got an idea for this Hulk monster, which...
Oh, by the way, Stan Lee cameo was one of the better ones.
This one was, yes. Yeah. Stan Lee's the guy that has the tainted gamma.
Yes, early, a quarter into the movie, yeah.
And just like he was...
Totally derailed you here. Yeah. But yeah, going back to the post-credits scene, Tony Stark and then...
Here's my question. Tony Stark's describing the Avengers initiative to General Ross. Mm-hmm. What the fuck good does that do? Ross just proved he can't capture the Hulk.
Yeah, Ross shouldn't be on his team. He's recruiting the wrong team.
Yeah, that's
fine. I mean, well, Tony's very established. He's, you know, even though he goes against them a little bit, but he's still pro-government.
Weird. Yeah, it's a good point, but weird.
But that'll come into play later.
Yeah, it will. You're right. That's a good point. That's a good explanation.
All right, so we go into Iron Man Deuce.
Yeah, let's move on to Iron Man 2.
The domestic box office was $312 million. Other territories, $311 million. Worldwide, $623.9 million.
So we're back up in that half a billion plus territory
$200 million budget. So this is some rake. Critical reception, Rotten Tomatoes, 73%, 6.5 out of 10.
Barely holding on to that certified fresh rating.
72% audience score, 3.7 out of 5. Metacritic, the big number on this presentation here, is 57 out of 100.
I don't know what the hell. This is so interesting to go back and review because you have the cinema score from last with the Hulk movie was an A-. This meta rating is so much lower than The Incredible Hulk. And I think we both agree Iron Man 2 is a better movie than The Incredible Hulk, at least.
Raised expectations would be my theory. Yeah. IMDb 7 out of 10 audience score over the years. So this has kind of come back to the mean in a little bit, because like we said, that's kind of a cumulative.
It's probably proper too. I think they have it about where it should be.
Right. Nominated for Best Visual Effects that year at the Oscars. Lost to Inception.
Which it should have.
My one production nugget. Terrence Howard recast as Colonel Rhodes. Recast by with Don Cheadle on the wishes of Jon Favreau. That's the rumor.
Really?
That's the scuttlebutt, who did not enjoy working with Howard, often reshooting and cutting Howard's scenes.
Ooh.
So that's tension. A little behind the scenes.
Don't expect Jon Favreau to guest star on Empire anytime soon, I guess.
I don't know. I don't know if that's true. We're not journalists.
$200 million budget.
We are far from journalists.
We're barely men. Now, $200 million budget, highest in Marvel's history, obviously, up to that point. This was supposed to be a big one. So you would think the $600 million mark might be a little disappointing to them. I don't know. I mean, you get three times its budget.
They're growing that foreign box office too, though, here.
It's true. Third highest domestic grossing film of 2010, seventh highest of the year in terms of worldwide gross. Did rake in $128+ million its opening weekend, which unadjusted still ranks for the 27th best opening weekend of all time, and at the time was number 5. Mm-hmm. So pretty amazing to see that the opening weekends keep going up and up too.
Yeah.
22 in the last 8 years here. So 2010, the gang's back. Tony Stark's here. Pepper Potts is here. The only guy that isn't is Terrence Howard. Jon Favreau behind the scenes. Do you see who wrote the screenplay for this?
Yeah, Justin Theroux.
The Justin Theroux. The former Mr.
The leftovers,
Aniston.
Yeah.
All right. So a little plot synopsis. Tony Stark is back, but he now deals with the difficulty of the world knowing his identity as the Iron Man. So automatically we're getting away from the Batman similarity, the Tony Stark, Bruce Wayne crossover.
Good. Yeah, no, that's true. I didn't think about it.
While still in his playboy ways, he encounters enemies, both those who want to destroy Iron Man and those who want to vanquish Stark Industries. Early on, we are introduced to Ivan Vanko, Whiplash, to his friends, who has a decades-long grudge against the Stark family dating back to Tony's father having wronged his own dad.
They're going
to
get so mad at you, all these comic book nerds, because he's a compilation.
Ivan Vanko is Whiplash, my boy. Take that, comic book nerds.
Hold on.
He is the comic book.
But he's
name
also
of
the Crimson Dynamo. He's
I don't care what Wikipedia
he's an
says.
Amalgam.
He's Whiplash. Further, Justin Hammer exists, played by Sam Rockwell, himself a weapons contractor who's trying to replicate Tony's Iron Man suit to better the tech and become entrenched in a high-powered government position in the Pentagon. This actually happens for Hammer as a result of Tony spiraling, resulting in him in Tony throwing a birthday bash that ends with himself slugging it out, iron suit and all, with best friend Rhodey, a.k.a. War Machine.
Some good effects in that one,
aforementioned Don Cheadle owning the suit instead of Terrence Howard. Rhodey brings the Stark Iron Suit to Hammer, who plans on using the recently busted out of jail Vanko to perfect and improve the tech, all to be shown off at a giant expo coming up, but little does everybody know that Vanko is only serving one master, himself, and maybe his bide. Which leads to Whiplash in an iron suit with drones against a repurposed and reignited Stark-Rhodey friendship. We also have the B storyline, Tony's coming of age, realizing his father did care and love about him, blah, blah, blah.
Right, him and Pepper taking another
him
step.
Him and Pepper go towards, they actually kiss for the first time in this film.
Yes, sir.
So and he also signed over Stark Industries. Pepper Potts becomes the CEO of Stark Industries.
So where it fits in the MCU, you get a lot of S.H.I.E.L.D. building.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, no doubt there. Agent Coulson, he kind of had a little cameo in the first Iron Man. He's back in a more prevalent way.
He basically escorted Pepper Potts out of the building with Obadiah Stane leering over them.
Yeah.
The glass windows.
We have a big scene involving Natasha Romanoff revealing herself as Black Widow. This Black is our introduction Widow. To Black Widow. I can't believe I forgot to mention her in the plot. That's my bad.
She kicks Happy's ass.
She's awesome in this, but she reveals herself as a member of S.H.I.E.L.D. Nick Fury makes a return. Agent Coulson, like we said, cryptically says mid-movie, two-thirds of the way through the movie, he's getting reassigned to New Mexico. He's going to be seen again at the end.
Yep, Thor.
So, yeah, you're right. This is kind of, this is the Tony Stark the Man / S.H.I.E.L.D. movie.
S.H.I.E.L.D. You get an origin story for S.H.I.E.L.D. Last time you got a derivation of their name, but now you kind of get more S.H.I.E.L.D. origin story stuff. They're sprinkling that in.
Who are the ones, of course,
in.
Behind the Avengers Initiative.
At the time, I remember the reviews came out and people hated the Samuel Jackson stuff. Like, it was just such... It took them off plot.
Racists!
But they got so mad at it because it was like such a skip and a jaunt.
But then again, and this is why sequels are so hard to master. What did you want out of this? You know, you have Tony Stark established as the Iron Man. This is the third Marvel movie in this giant three-phase MCU building. There's only so many pieces they have to work with. Now, you're introducing a new character who's very important in Black Widow.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. You give her a lot of depth and character building.
She should have gave her own movie freaking 12 films ago.
Listen, that is a totally...
She was a minted megastar at then, too. I mean, it's silly.
The fact that there's been no single Black Widow movie even in the production stages, I will never understand it.
They set it up perfectly.
It's so wrong.
They wouldn't even have to... It wouldn't even have to be as monster of a budget because she's just... It's just a spy movie.
Thank
God. You get a spy movie with
her. Thank God Margot Robbie is... picking up that slack and doing it herself with the Harley Quinn.
I mean, listen, I don't. Yeah, it should have been done.
Yeah, absolutely. Simple. But that's a side road we took there. But it's a point that needs to be made. But that said, they established Natasha Romanoff well in this movie. She's a very capable character. You talk about agency all the time. She's given tons of it in terms of standing up for herself anyway as an integral part of S.H.I.E.L.D. and what will be coming with the Avengers.
They ratchet up the dealings with the government. So they're really button heads now. I mean, he's before Congress and Gary Shandling's Congress.
How the hell is Gary Shandling in this movie? What the hell?
He's in more movies.
Yeah, I could not believe Gary Shandling was the guy they got for the congressman. He he's a Buddhist. He's like basically monk-like in his own very personal life.
Yeah.
Judd Apatow has a documentary coming about him, which is supposed to be really good, but... He kind of would not be the guy you think of to perform in these blockbuster movies. But yet there he is. Well,
he'd deliver
great job too.
A half a one-liner, I guess.
He was fine for what he was. He was supposed to be a dick. He was a dick.
He was a dick. So I like the Don Cheadle introduction where Don Cheadle's just kind of like, just get over it.
It's
get
me,
past it.
I'm it's... here. Let's move on.
Yeah. That was great.
I wish he was staring into the camera when he said that. Yeah, you're right. That was funny.
Tony's a little funnier in this movie, I thought, than the last one. I laughed more. Well, I chuckled. I almost chuckled.
You had a half smile.
I smirked. My what do they call it when you're in romance novels, Mike, that you read all the time that I see stacked up? No.
Cunnilinks.
He cracked a smile.
Yeah, sure.
That's what I was going for. You went somewhere else.
But again, the Tony moments in this movie are more, you know, there's less Iron Man, badass. It's more the spiral of the man, Tony Stark. He's dealing right. with middle age. He's dealing with having a father that didn't love him, not knowing where to go in life.
So why didn't we all, as a nation, love this movie as much as the first one? Was it because, I'm just going to throw a theory out here, was it because it was like rich people problems and get over it and figure it
or
out?
Or heavy-handedness with the government, too.
True.
I mean, this is a government movie. This is laced. You have people, nefarious people doing nefarious things behind the scenes to run the country, right. which was basically Hammer's entire arc.
They're cute with the villain again, you know.
Two very capable ones.
You have the power behind the guy who emerges on the scene, but it's not as innovative as the first movie in terms of what their plan was with the villain, because they sideline Mickey Rourke pretty early.
I'm going to talk about him a lot in a little bit.
That's my biggest problem. Like, why don't you keep building him up?
Well, they spent a lot of time, again, with the person of Tony Stark in lieu of the villain building. And I don't think they could settle on what dramatic pull they wanted Tony Stark to be. They had the father story.
Right.
They also had the health issue with his
I love the health dying. Issue. I love the was, issue itself. Yeah. I have a major problem with the fix.
Okay. Is that one of your worst scenes?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
It's coming.
All right. Good.
All right.
So I don't think they had a set plot. And that's one of my biggest problems, again, with this movie, is that stuff just kind of happens with no correlation to anything set up before it. I feel like they just went in a billion different directions and kind of to see what stuck. Kate Mara is in this movie randomly. The people that are in this movie with no impact or consequence.
It does feel like a big party. Everybody just wants a piece
exactly.
of it.
Exactly. It's like a Star Wars thing.
I agree.
And I think this might have been when the MCU was at its hot, most fever pitched, except for Infinity War.
They felt like something good was happening with it. Yeah, and it did make money. It could have been, if it was a great Marvel movie, this could have been close to $1 billion. I mean, this could have taken off.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So this movie's frustrating. I would agree. It's frustrating because it could have been so great.
Yeah,
I love the marketing for this movie. I loved, and I guess getting into Oscar lens, my best scene, that Formula One race sequence.
Looked great.
Oh, that was cool.
It looked great.
And it was great. The problem is they marketed the whole movie on that one sequence. So when it actually happened, you kind of expected it. But
it's very early in the film, too.
Upon rewatch, it still holds up. Like, that's a cool sequence. Like, of course he's impulsive enough just to get into the car.
You establish this villain as a character that can cut a car in half that's driving at full speed, but
why doesn't he fly?
When Happy's pinned him against the gate,
get out of the range and then shoot stuff at him.
He can't whip a car that's pinning him down. He can't just slice the car in half and get like inconsistencies again. And I know I'm nitpicking, but it's just stuff that kind of bothered me. Took me out of it.
Here's who would not have a problem with this movie. The creators of John Wick.
Okay.
Because Gun Fu was slightly almost born in this movie, because you're right. The close quarters fighting just doesn't make any sense. Why can't he fly away and shoot?
War Machine Iron Man fight. Let me do my best scene first.
There you go.
And then we'll get into it. As far as Oscar-ness, Sam Rockwell was great in this.
He was pretty good.
I mean, he could fight for best supporting actor from this year any day for me.
I still think he would have been. I just disagree with his character. Like, his character wouldn't defer to Tony that much. Like, he's like Tony's towel boy in all those scenes.
Because
like,
he's a coward.
Would be, but he would. Someone that high up, like a CEO like that, would to
I
me
totally disagree.
No, to me, they would be totally full of themselves.
He is, but he's also a coward. He's not real. It's all a shell. He wants to be Tony Stark. So, of course, he's admiring
him. He would be,
him.
In his own mind, his own Tony Stark.
Best Supporting Actors in 2010, Christian Bale won it for The Fighter. John Hawks for Winter's Bone. I can't remember him in that movie.
So you're making a
you
Sam
can make
Rockwell.
An argument. Yeah, you can make an argument that Rockwell has a more memorable performance. Jeremy Renner for The Town, that accent is...
I get mad at Sam Rockwell in this movie because he just sidelines the villain.
Yeah, but he is the bigger villain. In some ways, Justin Hammers.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. All right, he sidelined, but he, you're bet, Jeremy Renner you were talking about.
Jeremy Renner's in The Town was nominated. His accent goes in and out as much as Mickey Rourke's does in this movie. Mark Ruffalo, the kids are all right, would probably stay nominated. Jeffrey Rush would definitely stay nominated from The King's Speech. So Renner or Hawks, you could interplay with Rockwell, and I have, you know, you can make an argument for it. And it's nice to see Sam Rockwell not play a racist. So I think he deserves credit for that.
My most Oscar-worthy element, the visual effects are better in this film.
Without question.
They're also clever in putting practical effects in this one a little bit more.
Yeah.
And you have Robert Downey Jr. actually in a suit. So I really like again, special effects, it's got to fool you. Because you know, and it's really got to fool you because you know it's CGI. You know the things aren't real. You know you're in a superhero movie. So for them to actually incorporate all the, you know, the breaking up of his beautiful home and that fight in the middle of the movie, maybe that should have been my favorite scene, even though it's a down tilt scene, you know, down tilt sequence.
The fight between him and War Machine. No, that's my worst scene.
Well, I don't remember it that well, but I'm just saying, I like the effects in there.
I like the final battle.
Why is that your worst scene? You like the final battle?
Yeah, I like the final battle. You don't like the final battle?
I like moments of the final battle. All
right, let's dump in the worst scenes because let's get into it. That fucking fight between War Machine and Iron Man. First of all, you have a wasted Tony Stark who's supposed to be capable of fighting Rhodey.
So this is Rhodes versus Iron Man. They're pulling their punches there. So why do you have a problem with
that? Why are they punching? There should be no punching.
He's wasted on his deathbed, he thinks.
Okay. If you and I donned 8,000 pounds of armor to fight each other, we're not going to throw punches at one another. It would do nothing. It would do nothing. Well,
but they know it does nothing. So it knows that they know.
Okay, so yeah. Why do it? Like, it's
because
many times throughout this series,
boys will be boys. It was a boys will be boys kind of scene,
but especially with Iron Man, like, yeah. They make one these guys wasted. Become these robots when they're not. They're piloting these robots from the inside. Mm-hmm. They're just suits. So, like, the punching pissed me off. Where is Tony gonna live once this fight's over? His house has been totally destroyed. All right, that's a nitpick, but
it's a big house though. He flies to the donut.
Why are two iron-suited robots throwing punches at each other? That's right. Why is everybody just standing around outside the window once Tony told them to leave? And why is there only impetus to leave when Tony yells at them from inside the iron suit? Why does Cheadle just take off? When did Don Cheadle learn how to pilot the iron suit? Let me answer
some of them. It's hangers-on. He doesn't learn how to pilot the iron suit. That's a good point. They're hangers-on at the party. They don't really want to leave. They're not sure if he's serious.
But if they're scared enough by Tony yelling at them through the iron suit to leave,
why are they just hanging out on the lawn? Well, I don't know. We're going to have to agree to
Bikini
this
Beach Party.
I don't have any of those same problems. But I have problems coming up with the next sequence.
And Don Cheadle not learning how to fly is a big deal. Like, he's just in the iron suit. He knows how to fight. He knows how to do everything, and then he leaves.
The problem with that, and I'll grant you this, based on narrative weight, is you had so much time where Tony was kind of learning to fly it.
Right, exactly.
First movie. Yeah, you spent a lot of time where that was happening. A lot of currency was the word I was searching for. So the worst things about the movie for me is they sidelined the villain that was cool. Now, it was cool.
Whiplash.
Yeah. I still have another worst thing about the movie is that they... All Iron Man had to do was get in the air and shoot at him from a distance.
Yeah.
You didn't have to you don't have to go and get into a fist fight with him.
And why did it take him forever? That's good.
All right, and this is what I really hate. So you sideline the villain to do what? Put him back into his natural element where he makes, you know, something weapons. Awesome. Makes robot weapons.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And you have one scene after another hyping up these robots. And then all right, you got a showdown between Iron Man and War Machine and all these awesome robots. And then Iron Man goes, pew! Yeah,
the robots
blow up.
The finality of the final battle, I had a problem with. I when I said it was my favorite scene, I meant the leading up, the drones.
The drones were leading up to it that whole movie. And then they just got blown apart with one blast.
Well, they're robots. They're going against
give them
scientists.
Some body armor. You got bullets bouncing off of Iron Man and War Machine.
They also made the point plenty of times that they would not be fully ready in time for the expo, so they shouldn't have.
All right, good point. Good catch. That's why. But you spent, you know, that whole middle of the movie creating henchmen.
Yeah, it was. They were defeated easily. They're like the putties from the Power Rangers.
Yeah, come all you gotta on, do is
hit
man.
The Z in their chest. Yeah, I could see that. Why not?
Give those things some more teeth. Make, you know, overwhelm the two guys. If they have body armor, you have body armor. Overwhelm the two guys
and
with all those
drones. And I do concede
drones.
The final, the way they defeat Whiplash is kind of weak, even though it was set up with precedent by the two of them fighting and blowing out the glass window, which, by the way, would have killed everyone if they were having a beach party on the lawn, but nonetheless.
Well, the blast, ran away the blast and, was just so perfectly and conveniently small enough.
Yeah, there you go. That's what happened.
I'll give you that one, too.
But yeah, no, I these are all legitimate gripes. Like, our griping has become the physics of the world of the MCU. No, you're right, though. Yeah, and it was, Whiplash was kind of disappointing. Never mind Mickey Rourke yelling to the heavens early in the movie.
Oh, that was Wolverine bad. Yeah, that was. I agree.
That accent, Mickey Rourke holding an accent, was kind of rough. It was the height of the Rourkeissance. He had just come back from off the wrestler, had an Academy Award.
The Rourkeissance didn't last very
long. No, it didn't. It did not last very long because he went more Botox and got even weirder looking. Like, he was, but he was hot for that 2-year run between the wrestler and good Lord,
old
Iron Man 2.
Don't get shinier. What's wrong with you?
He had an appearance at WrestleMania 25. He punched out Chris Jericho. Yeah. They were all in on him.
Oh, my God.
He was supposed to fight there, but that's a different story for a different podcast. But last thing, post-credits scene. Well, the end of the movie is Tony Stark meeting with Nick Fury. Nick Fury telling him, basically, we don't think you're fit for the Avengers Initiative anymore. We want you as a consultant.
You can't afford me.
Yeah, Tony Stark saying, you can't afford me. But then he relents and he says he'll do it if basically him and Rhodey can get medals of honor presented by Gary Shandling.
Oh, right.
At the very
right,
end.
Right.
That
right.
was funny.
That was good.
Post-credit scene, we have Agent Coulson in the desert in New Mexico making a phone call saying we found it and we're left with this pulled back image on Thor's hammer.
They have more confidence in themselves now. All right, now we're giving you Thor. They got confidence.
Right. We got the ball rolling.
The Hulk didn't work, but they're giving you Thor.
So what do you think overall, these three films is a start to our MCU?
Showing a lot of promise. And I don't know if I came off giving Iron Man 2 some of, you know, its highs, because I do think it had some highs.
We're most disappointed in the Hulk of these three.
I think watching the Hulk at the time, I didn't have as many problems with it as I do now. I don't know what that says
about
me.
It almost feels like a totally separate entity. Like, it doesn't feel in line with the two Iron Man films. Or as much as I imagine Thor's will, Captain America's will. It kind of feels like it was done by a different company.
I liked it more back then. Now, watching it now, I did not enjoy myself, except for the callbacks and the nostalgia, the member berries. So
we have two members of the, or three members, four if you count Nick Fury, but three members of the Avengers are introduced. They're here. They're established. Tony Stark the most. Natasha Romanoff.
Yeah, missed Black opportunities Widow. With Black Widow.
Big time.
For sure. She was fascinating.
She only gets her one scene to shine, too, beating up guys.
Yeah, I mean, they started to read the tea leaves after Hulk, after the Macho movie failed, right? Mm-hmm. The ultimate Macho movie, sinking the ultimate Macho dollars into it, falls on its face. You give Pepper Potts a ton of agency. You get Natasha Romanoff, Black Widow involved. I think they understood.
Times were changing.
Yeah. What's going to butter their bread going forward? I mean, again, should have been obvious because, all right, make a movie that just appeals to more than, 40% of the population would be a good idea.
Yeah.
And that's not just guys. That's just, but maybe 30% of the pop, macho guys.
Right.
All right.
Come on. Decent thought. Yeah, so this is where we are. We're started. We have Iron Man, who found out that his father loved him. Tony, my greatest creation ever.
Did
is you.
Though? Other movies coming up.
Bit on the nose. Incredible Hulk. We will never see Ed Norton's Bruce Banner again. He is gone from this world.
Very true.
He will soon turn into Mark Ruffalo.
We never saw another movie, big budget movie, starring Ed Norton again.
Yeah.
Like as a protagonist.
And Romanoff, Pepper Potts, and Nick Fury are all here. Black Widow, and we're going to go next to Thor, Captain America, the First Avenger, and then the first biggie of Phase 1.
Yes, they start to pick up steam.
Marvel's The Avengers is our sixth movie we will review. Those three will be next on our list, and if you are excited for Infinity War, that means you have a pulse. Let us know about it. Let us know what your pulse is. If you're not excited, you're dead. Still tweet us. if you're dead, because that's amazing.
That'll be a cheap follow on our part, but we'll take the follow. So do it.
So let us know. Get at us. We're Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook, Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram, MM and Oscar on the Twitter machine, Mike, Mike, and Oscar at gmail.com, Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Reddit.
We come off a little desperate there, my friend. Maybe we can.
You don't want a ghost tweeting at us? If an actual ghost tweets at us, you know how awesome that'd be?
We had a pre-pod conversation about how do we master Twitter? And this is
speak to the dead.
This is your solution. Oh my god.
Forget what also Mike's saying. If you're the undead, I want to hear from
follow
you.
Us on Twitter.
Frankenberries 1496.
Some of the bots to follow us on Twitter at MM and Oscar. Very good.
We hope you enjoyed this, guys. We will see you next time.
All bots welcome.
Reality sucks. Keep watching movies with us.
See ya.